Cue Henry Mancini, please. Sunday night, and that means from high above beautiful Lake Osceola in downtown Jefferson Valley, New York, the John Mack Radio Show is on the air. Good evening, this is John McMullen, John Mack, to some welcome you to the 300th episode, possibly the last, and possibly not, of the weekly John Mack Radio Show. I'll be taking a hiatus from the show for the rest of November and December, and will determine by early January what my ongoing plans will be. The recording for the previous 299 shows may be found at www.johnmack13.com under the radio show tab. And John Mack is J-O-H-N-M-A-C. That's www.johnmack13.com under the radio show tab. In addition to the previous radio shows, you'll also find links to my online daily newsletter at my web home. The newsletter is a curation of 10 news articles from around the country and the world. Try it and subscribe. Only one email per day, and it's free. Once again, that's www.johnmack13.com, and the newsletter will continue during my hiatus. Before getting into tonight's conversations, some announcements. First, personal. My latest book, The Trump File, a short collection of poems dating back to 2009 and short story, is now available on Amazon, both in print and in Kindle format. Additionally, I am in the late stages of editing the Hunsett Valley Anthology 2019, a collection of the writing of slightly over 60 of today's writers. I am shooting for its release in late November. And now some local Hudson Valley news. Writers in the Hudson Valley should be aware that every Thursday evening is the weekly meeting of the Mahopac Writers Group, now in its 23rd year, at 6:30 p.m. at the Mahopac Library on 6 in Mahopac. More than 175 books have been published by writers from this group. Once a month, the same group also has a morning meeting on the third Wednesday of the month. So Wednesday's meeting will be at Wednesday, November 20th at 10 a.m. at the Hill Boulevard Diner, which is surprisingly on Hill Boulevard, just west of Route 6 in Jefferson Valley. There are also two poetry workshops in the area, open to both fledgling and experienced poets, one in Mahopac and one in Yorktown. The Mahopac one is held on the second Wednesday of the month at the Mahopac Library at 6:30. So this this month's one will be held this Wednesday night. The Yorktown one is normally held on the fourth Wednesday at the John C. Hart Library in Treboke, but due to Thanksgiving and Christmas holidays, we'll be moving to the third Wednesday in November and December. And it will next meet on Wednesday evening at 6 p.m. on November 20th. Finally, the November open mic session of the wonderful Hudson Valley Writers Center will be on Friday, November 15th, in the scenic Philipsey Mount train station overlooking the Hudson in Sleepy Hollow, New York. There will be a featured artist followed by an open mic session. The theme of the open mic this month will be 1 year until the 2020 election. But readers are not bound by the theme. A complete guide to all of the center's many offerings, workshops, classes, readings, collaborative writing, can be found at writerscenter.org. That's writerscenter, one word, WriterScenter.org. Anyone wishing more information on any of these meetings may contact me at johnmack13@gmail.com. That's johnmack13@gmail.com. I was privileged to participate on Saturday at a Veterans Day program in Brewster, New York, and I will read some of the poems that I read during the course of this show. The program was one of a multi-weekend program sponsored by the Joseph E. Dwyer Vet Program of Putnam County under the direction of John Borges, who was both a veteran of the Iraq War and a retired police officer. And now to tonight's show. I extended an invitation to previous guests of the show to call in if the spirit moves them and fill the audience in on their current activities. I will fill in gaps with poetry and some music. And starting off, I will read some of the poems, three to be exact, that I read at the Veterans Gala the last Saturday. Veterans Day statistics. I live in the town of Yorktown, New York. It's a mid-sized Lower Hudson Valley town with a population in 2018 of 36,900. If I multiply that by 1.5, I get 55,350. That's a lot of people. 58,220 Americans were killed in Vietnam, more than one and a half times the number in my Westchester town. Something to think about as we approach Veterans Day. Then there was a poem that I wrote earlier in May after I attended something in my old neighborhood. It's called Vietnam 1968. I was at the dedication of a memorial at the parish church of my youth the last week. A memorial to honor those from the neighborhood who gave their lives during that awful war. The priest who not only grew up in the neighborhood but also served there for many years was one of the speakers. He was well qualified to speak on Vietnam. He won the Silver Star and two bronze ones. The day brought back terrible memories of that awful war, not only for the dead brothers of friends being commemorated, but of a nation that behaved very badly. We had construction workers beating up anti-war protesters on Wall Street, and the country torn apart by the war, turning its back on those who did their country's bidding, and then returned home injured with what we now call PTSD, or the victim of Agent Orange. Some were upset that we were even in Vietnam and pointed out the lies told us by two presidents, while others were aghast that we pulled out of a war that we did not win. However, the American soldier had no responsibility for any of that. He or she only did what they were ordered to do and at great peril to themselves. the country grew up a lot after that. When we came to another war of dubious cause in Iraq, we did not turn our backs on veterans, no matter what our positions were in the conflict. It's a pity that 58,220 had to give their lives to teach us how to behave. And then a third poem, and I'll fill you in on the end of that after I read it. Tommy Minogue didn't decide. Tommy Minogue, the younger brother of Prince, my old neighbor, didn't decide to send advisor to Vietnam. Dwight Eisenhower did. Tommy Minogue didn't decide to send special forces to Vietnam. John F. Kennedy did. Tommy Minogue didn't decide to escalate the war on the phony Gulf of Tompkins story. Lyndon Johnson did. Tommy Minogue didn't decide to heavily bomb North Vietnam. Richard Nixon did. Tommy Minogue didn't decide to bring the troops home. Gerald Ford did. Tommy Minogue didn't even decide to go to Vietnam. The Army sent him. Tommy Minogue didn't decide to win the Distinguished Service Cross. It was awarded posthumously. After I wrote that poem, I called to one of the older brothers, and I asked him to whether he would have any difficulty of me reading it at a veterans thing. And he thanked me for it and said no. He was very happy that I remember his brother Tommy. His brother Tommy had been nominated for the Congressional Medal, and it went all the way up to the chairman of the Joint Chief of Staff and was turned down because two members of his unit had already won it in previous months. And since then, there have been members of Congress who have been trying to reverse the decision, and there's been articles as recently as last year in the newspapers. So it's still alive. Now I see we have a caller on the phone from the 845 number. Who do I have on the phone?
John, I don't know. I'm 845. What's the rest of the number?
You're on, Priscilla.
It's Priscilla. Hi, how are you? Congratulations on your 300th show. That's wonderful. That's fantastic.
Thank you. And why don't you tell us what you're up to with your writing and your travel and the like?
Well, with my writing, I've been actually doing a little bit more reading than writing lately. I've been trying to read a little bit more poetry, and I've just discovered an absolutely wonderful book, which I mentioned to you the other day, by the former poet laureate of the U.S., Ted Kooser, called The Poetry Home Repair Manual. I'm interested in learning how to write poetry, so I'm finding that reading a lot of it, listening to a lot of it, certainly yours, as well as some of the others in the poetry workshop, reading it where I can find it. And now this book is really, I find, very informative, very accessible, very clearly written, and quite encouraging. So that's one of the things I'm doing. Yeah.
You're also doing research on the World War II veteran, which ties directly
I am. Yes, I've reached a point where I have about 109 items that I want to fact check. I think I've taken the writing as far as I can, and now I want to just go back and make sure that certain items I've included are factual. And then I want to just finish off the piece. And my goal is to turn it over to his family and try to find a place where the story can be held. Possibly the Minnesota Historical Society or one of the Air Force museums, so that the story will
be there.
Excuse me?
Could you tell us the whole story for the audience?
I will tell you the story. I was traveling in England and happened to be passing an area that I wasn't familiar with, and noticed a large American flag flying, and I wondered why, so I pulled over. And it turned out it was a memorial to an American pilot, a 24-year-old kid from Minneapolis, who was the pilot of a plane called Spare Parts, although that was not the plane he was flying that day. These airmen were flying out of England doing the heavy bombardment prior to D-Day. The English were flying at night. The Americans were flying during the day. And on his mission, his bombing mission that day, where they were really in the entire effort trying to take out the airfields and factories and so on to weaken Germany before the D-Day invasion, his plane was shot up. He was injured and half the crew was injured. They managed to get back across the English Channel, but after they crossed land, the plane burst into flame, and he ordered everyone in his crew to jump, which they did, and everyone got out safely, even the last guy who went out at 700 feet. He tried to avoid the little village and crash-landed and died on impact. And so the people in the village have remembered him ever since 1944. It was April 13th, 1944. And they've remembered him with a ceremony each year, and with this lovely little his name was William Johnson, Johnson's Corner. So I was really moved by that, and I wanted to find out who he was. I mean, I've got three sons, and I figured he must have a mother and a father and probably siblings. So I wanted to find out more about him, what took him to be in that spot, and what made him the man he was, who was able to be so brave in his actions. Brave and decisive in his actions. So I've been researching and writing about him since.
And how far have you gotten? You actually had some luck in finding information, didn't you?
I did. It was challenging. I was able to meet his sister before she died, but before I could even find her, I had to figure out which William Johnson he was in the city of Minneapolis. There are quite a few people by the name of William Johnson in Minneapolis. And I actually at one point had just given up, and I decided I would take a totally different direction and just try researching something else for a while, something else about the story. And so I thought, you know, there must be someone in the area where the plane crashed in Kent in England. Maybe there are some old records there, some history, some people who were alive at the time. And I just made a cold call to a realtor, a real estate agency in the area, thinking they could tell me something about the farm that his plane actually crashed in instead of crashing in the middle of the little village. And in that call, I was connected to someone who gave me the name of a man who had been in the local pub when Bill Johnson, the family of this pilot, had come looking for the place where he crashed in the 1990s. And so I've gotten to know that fellow quite well, and he's the one that put me in touch with Bill Johnson's family back in Minneapolis. So that gave me an opening to actually talk to his sister, one of only two people that I've been able to meet who are still alive, and who knew him.
And so moving along, and after you get back from your travels, you'll get back into writing about it.
Exactly. I'm looking forward to finishing it and putting it in the hands of his family. I think some of them don't even know all of the details of what happened. I think at this point I probably may know more than they do. And they should have that story. It's a family story.
I agree with some of the people in the writers group who have suggested that you should also place this in the Military History Journal.
Yes,
for everyone.
It's possible. Yeah, if I will find the right place to put it, I would definitely consider doing that. But first, I'd like to get it to his family.
Okay, all right. I'm going to turn something on that relates, in my mind, to I read over the weekend into Priscilla's story. And then we'll come right back.
Where have all the flowers gone? Long time passing. Where have all the flowers gone? Long time ago. Where have all the flowers gone? The girls have picked them, everyone. Oh, when will you ever learn? Oh, when will you ever learn? young girl's gone. Long time passing, where have all the young girls gone? Long time ago, where have all the young girls gone? They've taken husbands, everyone. Oh, when will you ever learn? Oh, when will you ever learn? Where have all the young men gone? Long time passing. Where have all the young men gone? Long time ago. Where have all the young men gone? They're all in uniform. Oh, when will we ever learn? Oh, when will we ever learn?
Yeah, that's the that was a great anti-war song, I think. I have someone else on from the 914-428 number. Just let me pick it up. Who else do I have on the phone?
Well, John, it's a pleasure to be talking to you again. This is Paul Levinson, and I can't believe so many years have gone by since the first time I was on your show, on your first show back in 2013.
Yes, Paul for the audience is both a professor at Fordham University. He's a fiction and a nonfiction writer. He's written some science fiction. He's also written some music. He's performed it at a book party that we had at Coogan's restaurant probably in 2015.
Right.
And what are you doing?
Well, actually, I just got back from one of the best science fiction conventions in the world. In fact, it's the oldest continuing convention, at least in the United States. It's called PhilCon, and apropos the name, it takes place in Philadelphia. And I just had a wonderful time. Tina and I were there, you know, the whole weekend, and I was reading from my latest story that's going to be published in Amazing Stories. But in fact, probably the most exciting thing that happened, or you mentioned my music, is I debuted songs from my brand new album called Welcome Up, Songs of Space and Time. And that was really, it was really a thrill. You know, my other album came out in 1972. So I had a master plan of waiting almost 50 years until I came out with my second album. But a record company got interested in it, and that's going to be released, you know, probably in a month or so. And but, you know, it's always a buzz going to science fiction conventions because everybody that you run into, if you're any kind of, you know, science fiction writer with any kind of reputation, you know, you've been published anywhere that people read, they know you and your work, and it's a magical experience.
Yeah, I have a pseudo cousin named Sean McMullen, who's from Australia, and he's published regularly in the in Asimov's. And one funny thing, I was part of an anthology on technology when I was writing about technology back in 1983, I guess, called Digital Deli. And one of the other writers in it was Ray Bradbury. And 30 years later, my son was on the panel at Comic-Con in San Diego, and Bradbury was the keynote speaker, so things came full circle.
Yeah, I know Sean McMullen's work. I think I've met him once or twice also, maybe like at a Worldcon, but he's a talented author, and I had the pleasure of meeting Ray Bradbury once in person when I was president of the Science Fiction Writers of America, and if I'm not mistaken, it was the yearly Nebula Awards conference that we had that year in Los Angeles. That would have been 2000. And Ray was like one of our honored guests, and he was really spectacular. In fact, he was doing a book signing someplace in Los Angeles, and he had such a huge line that he was supposed to be talking at our conference, and he got there like 3 hours late because he didn't want to turn down anyone who was waiting for an autograph. And I guess he was probably in his late 70s, early 80s by then, and everyone thought he was going to be too tired to show up. But he not only showed up, he stood up, gave a great talk. So he was a fabulous writer.
Yeah, I remember when really to the general public, the ones that were known the most were both him and Isaac Asimov. And Isaac Asimov had 400 books, and a lot of people didn't realize at that time, but he was also the sensuous man, M, that wrote the that book. So he had his hand in everything.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah, Isaac, go ahead.
Now, you played music, though, at the book fair we had at Coogan's. That must have been 20 years after you had your album. Where did that music come from?
I think, wasn't that music from my album? I might have played some cuts, from Twice Upon a Rhyme. Although I had some demos of some songs, but I actually don't recall, what exactly I played. What happened was I did the album in 1972, and then over the years, every once in a while, I'd write a new song. I would get together with the guitarist, name is Peter Rosenthal. We wrote some songs, actually also around 2000. It's possible that I remember that Coogan's event very well. It was delightful. I don't think I brought any instruments, though. I mean, maybe I was singing against a recorded track or something, but
you played it on a boombox.
Okay, right. That makes sense, right. And I sang against that, yeah. That's right.
Now that the technology has changed dramatically and everything is MP3 and everything, how will you be releasing it? Will it be through iTunes or will it be up on Amazon? Or how will you be releasing the album?
Well, it's going to be released in three ways. And all this, by the way, is through a small record company in Buffalo, New York, called Old Bear Records. And so, yes, it is going to be released digitally. It'll be on Amazon, iTunes, everywhere, Spotify. It's going to be released on a CD, and it's going to be released on an old-fashioned vinyl record that you can put on a turntable and play. As a matter of fact, I just today signed off on the cover for both the CD and the album, and it's a really nice cover. It was a real, surprise to me. What happened was last summer, so we're talking summer 2018, I get an email from this guy, Chris Hoisington, who's part of Old Bear Records, and he basically said to me, hey, I'm a fan of your science fiction. I'm a fan of your music. I love Twice Upon a Rhyme. Have you ever written any science fiction songs? I said, well, yeah, as a matter of fact, I have. And so he said, well, why don't we record an album? And you didn't have to ask twice. And I'll tell you, almost every song has a story behind it. One of my favorite, though, is in 1968, I started writing a song called Welcome Up, and all I had was like one verse. And I was writing it for Tina, who then was my girlfriend. And you know how it is with writing. Sometimes you start writing something, you finish it right away. Other times you start writing something, and it can take years. So this song, I started writing, and I just didn't know where to go with it after the first verse. As a matter of fact, I was daydreaming on a bus a couple of weeks later, and I had this daydream of Paul McCartney coming to me on the bus and saying, hey, man, here's what your next line should be. So I got another line from Paul McCartney that way, but I still didn't know where to go with it. So when I told Tina about this new album, she said, hey, I did the right thing. Even though you didn't finish the song for me, I did marry you. So, why don't you finish the song now? And I said, that's a good idea. And I sat down on the piano and finished it. So In fact, the name of the song, Welcome Up, is the where we got the title for the album, Welcome Up, Songs of Space and Time. But each of the songs has a story. Some were written recently, some were written a long time ago. And they have a great little studio up there in Batavia, New York. It's like a little town not that far from Buffalo. And that in itself was like a scene out of a movie, going into that studio for a couple of days. It was a really cool thing, and I did that just about a year ago.
Now, when I first met you, you were at the New School, and then you moved to Fordham. Are you still teaching at Fordham? And if so, what are you teaching?
Well, I'm still teaching at Fordham. You know, they have to drag my body out. You know, I still enjoy it. I still get a kick out of going into a classroom and everybody listening to what I'm saying. You know, it's still a rarity. Where else are you going to get that? And I really enjoy my courses. So, you know, I have tenure. When I was chair of the department, you know, about 15 years ago, we had a professor who was in his mid-90s. So, I'm taking a lesson from him, and I'm just going to keep on teaching. And what I'm teaching, I mean, you'd appreciate this, John. You know, one thing about Trump, I call him the professor's best friend, because I teach a course, Digital Media and Public Responsibility. I teach another course, Communication Ethics in the Public Sphere. And I prepare a syllabus, but there's not a term that goes by when the syllabus is rewritten almost on a daily basis because of Trump. So, you know, as bad as he is for the country and the world and for humanity in general, he's been helpful to me as a professor. I still like to see him voted out of office or impeached, though, and thrown out of office. But that's another story.
Priscilla, do you have any questions for Paul? I know you haven't met Paul ever.
I'm sorry, John. I missed that.
Do you have any questions for a college professor and science fiction writer and music writer, Paul Levinson?
I'm intrigued by the combination of science fiction and music, and I have never gotten into science fiction, so I would love to know, I'd love to know the name of one of your books that you would recommend as a way of getting me involved and interested in reading science fiction.
Okay. Well, I can first of all, I'll mention briefly three of my books, and then I can also cite some other books as well. If the notion of time travel appeals to you, going back into the past and changing something or trying to change something, my best-known novel on that theme is called The Plot to Save Socrates. If ancient prehistoric history appeals to you, my very first novel is called The Silk Code, and it's basically a story in which Neanderthals managed to survive into the present age. And it also features a New York City detective, so it's sort of a mystery detective science fiction hybrid. And then I have a novel called Borrowed Tides about the first starship to Alpha Centauri. So if space travel is something that intrigues you, you might find that enjoyable. As far as who else I would recommend, there is one science fiction writer that to me has always been just in a class by himself, because he wrote at least three kinds of stories, and each of those were, I think, the best that's ever been written. One are his robot stories. And, you know, if you like or have heard of Westworld on HBO and Androids, Asimov is a great place to start. Isaac Asimov, he wrote novels and short stories. Anything where you see he's writing about his robots, that's great. Then he also wrote something called the Foundation Trilogy, and he expanded that greatly. And if you're interested in how someone with superior knowledge might be able to change the course of history and how difficult that is, you can't go wrong with the Foundation Trilogy. And then finally, apropos time travel, as much as I like my own work, the best time travel novel I ever read is, again, by Isaac Asimov. It's called The End of Eternity. And just so you know, I mean, these are books that go back, you know, to the 1940s, 1950s.
Yeah.
They've been around a long time, but they're really wonderful reading. And every time I've recommended them to someone, they've always thanked me afterwards. So.
Well, Asimov is a name I'm familiar with, and time travel is very intriguing. I think your book sounds fascinating. And also, although I was a little unsure at first about Neanderthals in the present age, I like the idea of their, you know, the New York City connection.
Yeah.
So I'm very much looking forward to digging into those.
Well, good. I hope you enjoy them. And are you on Facebook by any chance, or
mm-hmm.
Twitter or any of those places?
Yes.
Okay. So, well, I am at Paul Lev on Twitter. And I'm just Paul Levinson. There might be more than one Paul Levinson, but you'll recognize my account because I'm talking about my books and stuff. If you ever do get a chance to read any of, you know, my work, send me a note. Let me know what you thought of it. And also you can friend me and we can keep in touch that way.
That sounds great. Thanks.
Take care.
I'm gonna go back to my old neighborhood to when I was very young, and the first thing that I remember, it was listening to the radio, and that's where I am now with the Lone Ranger and with other things. But on Sunday mornings, there was a show called The Children's Hour with Ed Hurley, sponsored by Horn and Hard Arts, and the theme song.
East side, west side, that's right. Great song.
Oh my gosh.
Beautiful.
That takes me back.
Yes, me and Mamie O'Rourke.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love that song.
That volume's low. That was gonna take me into something that I had written about my old neighbor called my Inwood. I was born and raised in the Inwood section at the very top of Manhattan Island. It was an Irish Catholic Jewish section then. Each group thought that the neighbor belonged to them, and they were both right. It had three claims to fame then. A giant park with a large real forest, Columbia University's football stadium, and more bars than any neighbor in New York City. People came from all over to watch football, play in the park, and drink in the bars. Walter Winchell called at Ginwood in the press and on the radio. The legal drinking age in New York then was 18, so we could start in the park at 15 or 16. When I first tasted beer, I didn't like it. That soon changed. We moved to the bars at 17 or 18. Whether in the park or in the bars, the beer was merely the catalyst. It was a conversation that bonded us. I no longer imbibe. In the words of the great sports writer Jimmy Cannon, I stopped drinking 25 years ago. I retired with the title. I knew a number who fell into the bottle. Most of them did not. We became engineers, the lawyers, the accountants, writers, and technologists. Were it not for the half-quart cans of Pabst and the advent of the desktop computer, I would never have become the writer. So I owe a lot to the neighbor and to the culture. I go back once a month for a luncheon. There are now very few bars. The neighborhood is Dominican at one end and gentrified and expensive at the other. The times and stores may be different, but the friendships and memories live on. Inwood is now a state of the mind. Who's got the church key? So that's my memory of my old neighborhood. And the music then got us into things was first First it was the Sinatra music, then it was things like Dragnet, and then finally it was rock and roll with Bill Haley and with many others. Paul, when did you start listening to music?
Well, not with Frank Sinatra or anything quite that early, but certainly rock and roll, certainly Bill Haley. I have a very vivid memory, and I grew up in the Bronx around Allerton Avenue and White Plains Road, and I have a very vivid memory when I was a kid. I guess I was in the fifth or sixth grade, so we're talking about 1957, 1958, of listening to WINS. And, I mean, what a lineup just of disc jockeys. On the same Saturday night, there was a show by Murray the K, who went on to become really famous later, and Alan Freed, who was already famous. And it was just ear-opening, and I loved everything I heard. And I have been, in love with, that kind of music ever since. As a matter of fact, from my perspective as a kid in the 50s, there were really two things that were going on that were really, really important in what we would later call the popular culture. One was rock and roll, and the other was science fiction, because that's when I started reading Asimov and Robert Heinlein and Arthur C. Clarke and James Blish and all those writers. Literally, at the same time I was reading them, I was listening to WINS and then later WMCA and WABC on the radio. And I do feel, I hate to sound like, sort of like sadly nostalgic, and as much as I love the evolution of media and the new things that have come along, I miss those radio days. I mean, radio, there was something about that. It, obviously, it still exists, but people don't listen to music on the radio the way they used to, when it was basically the only way you could get that music immediately.
You also, it's changed a bit in that the reason I mentioned Sinatra, I came back to him later. My mother liked him and Bing Crosby. I came back to him when the white people started singing rock and roll, like Tab Hunter and Frank.
And my God.
Then the Beatles and Dylan brought me back. Pat Boone was actually a very good singer when he sang his own things, but when he tried to sing a Little Richard's things and Pat Domino things, he was just god awful. But
right.
I went to some Alton Freed shows. First, the show that he had at the New York Academy of Music, and then he used to have a free weekly show on WCBS, and people used to line up for hours. And I saw Chuck Berry there and a bunch, and I used to go to the Apollo too and saw Bo Diddley and all sorts of people. Did you ever get to any shows or anything?
Yeah, not to the Apollo. I'm sorry I didn't. But I did get once to the Brooklyn Fox and saw one of Murray the K's shows. That would have been, like 63, 64. As a matter of fact, though, something even more memorable. I'm sure you remember Freedom Land, right, in the Bronx? So that actually was not that far from where I lived. So I went there a bunch of times. And it went, Freedomland was, in case any listener doesn't know, sort of like an amusement park. And they went through various financial permutations, including one in which you paid like a small amount of money. Otherwise, I wouldn't have paid it, like maybe $5, which actually was a lot of money back then, but it wasn't that much money, to go into the park, and you could do anything you wanted in the park for hours and hours. Then it changed, and they would charge for each of the rides. Anyway, one of the times I went there, this is probably like 1964, 65, I'm walking around there, and I see that there's a sign, Murray the K is having a concert in this like little outdoor concert hall, and so I already knew who Murray the K was. So I went down there, and who did he have there but the Four Tops, who were just beginning, you know, to break in on Motown. And it was just a concert with only the four tops, and it was absolutely fabulous. And years later, in 1972, when Murray the K, who'd been out of New York for a while, you know, in Washington, I think in Montreal, he came back to New York. He was on WNBC, and they gave him, like, a show. At first it started on weekends, then it expanded. So I wrote a piece, actually, and I sent it into the Village Voice, and they published it about Murray the K's return to New York. Murray liked the piece, called me, and hired me to sort of work as one of his producers. But that only lasted about 3 or 4 months, because then Murray went on to do other things. But he was a real character.
Bruce Morrow described Murray the K as one of the worst people in the world, because there was a competition on WYNS, and according to him, Murray was always trying to sandbag him. One of my experiences in the Apollo, we're up in the balcony, and Bo Diddley's playing, and there's four of us, and we're the only white people definitely in the balcony, maybe in the entire theater. And Bo Diddley changed the lyrics to "Who Do You Love" and said, "Tell me, Arlene, why does white milk make yellow butter?" Everyone turned around and they stared at us. And then he went on singing, and they turned around. And I had no idea what that meant. And I used to ask people, black and white, for years, and finally we came on the consensus that they were talking about white men with black women making mulatto children. So.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, listen, this, you know, we didn't realize it as kids, as you were just saying, but there were all kinds of innuendos, subtle and not so subtle, in rock and roll. As a matter of fact, you probably know, rock and roll, just that phrase, was slang for having sex. And,
right.
So, you know, and as a kid, I had no idea that that was what it was about. But, I mean, you know, it is interesting, though, because I was listening. I listen, you know, all the time now to the Beatles channel on Sirius XM Radio. And they play a lot of pre-Beatles songs that inspired the Beatles. And if you listen to some of those, like, R&B rock and roll songs from the 50s, I mean, you talk about sexist. I mean, they were just, you know, outrageously belittling to women. And the Beatles actually picked up on some of that. I mean, if you think about some of, like, John Lennon's song, you know, "I'd rather see a dead little girl than to see you with another man." I mean, you know, nowadays, if somebody came out with a song like that, nobody would play it anyplace. But so there was that, you know, nasty edge to rock and roll. And, you know, back then, we kids, we realized, we got the energy, but we didn't really get what the lyrics were about very often.
There was, I go back to rhythm, them blues and the Nappy Browns and the other people, and there was one fellow whose name escapes me. We used to listen to his songs, and he had one song, "Get Out of the Car," and it was, and one of the lines was, "So I said to her, slide over closer," and she slid over real far to the other side, and I said, "Uh oh, baby, get out of the car, you got to walk home, baby," you know. This is, never have anything like that.
Oh, yeah.
What was the music like growing up in Tony, Connecticut?
Well, it was. I was listening to the same music that you were. I remember Murray the K and his swinging soiree.
That's right.
We were not cool though where we were. The coolest we were was when we were listening to whatever we could get on the radio. I grew up with radio. I mean, I don't think we had a TV until somewhere in the middle 1950s, maybe. And so I listened to radio all the time and loved it and loved the music. But my musical education was interrupted by a stint in the Peace Corps. And I missed a really critical time in the development of rock and roll. I don't know what they'd still call it, rock and roll, but I was overseas for 2 years, during which time Yellow Submarine, Sergeant Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band came out, mm-hmm. which was so, I heard it while I was in Uganda, and it sounded like something from another planet. And so I missed a lot of the things that were happening. And when I came back, I never really picked up on popular music again. I guess I'd missed the sort of a transitional period. And you could probably speak, both of you could probably speak more to what was going on in the middle 1960s.
Well, I'll tell you something. You know, here's like a dirty little secret, at least in my opinion. Yeah, you missed something big with Sgt. Pepper, and the Beatles had a few more albums, and there was some great music in the late 60s and early 70s, but I'm sure a lot of people won't agree with this. After that, although there have been some good songs, there have been some great groups, the heyday of the music was, you know, from the mid to the late 60s. So you probably got some of it anyway.
I got a little bit at the beginning, yeah.
Yeah.
So.
But one further thing, Paul, that you'll appreciate, Priscilla's father had a radio station, and Priscilla got to know a very important person in the history of radio. Why don't you mention that, Priscilla?
I hope you're talking about Bob Elliott and Ray Goulding.
I am.
Or were you talking about Jinx Falkenberg and Tex McCrary?
No, I did actually.
My dad was friends with Bob and Ray. He was working for NBC, and I got to meet them a couple of times. And I remember going, I don't know if you remember this, probably most people don't unless they were really into Bob and Ray, but they were in a show on Broadway. I can't even think when that would have been. John, you might remember the 70s or the 80s, maybe.
Was it probably that?
70s,
probably, yeah.
70s, yeah. And I remember going backstage to see them. They were fantastic. Somewhere in my attic, which I'm in the process of cleaning out, I have a black and white publicity photo of the two of them autographed to me.
Uh-huh.
And I treasure it.
It was a magical time. I think it was Hegel who talked about the spirit of an age. And I don't agree with a lot of Hegel's philosophy, but I think he really captured something there. And what he was saying was, if you look at any particular time and, you know, you're looking in the right way, you can see that music, literature, art, everything begins revolving around, you know, a similar topic and like a similar theme, almost a similar sense or spirit. And, you know, however long that lasts, that typifies that age. So, you know, if you think about Impressionism much earlier, you have Impressionistic art, Impressionistic poetry, Impressionistic music. I think the music of the 1960s wasn't impressionistic, but it captured something of its own, and it pulled a lot of other things into it, and really changed the way we think and feel. And I think we're still in that age now to some extent.
Go ahead, John.
Oh, go ahead, Priscilla. Go ahead.
It sounds like you're saying we're in a stage of arrested development.
Not arrested, because that sounds like negative. You know, it's more dynamic than that. What I'm saying was, I think, for example, the Beatles. And I mentioned before I listen to the Beatles channel all the time, but I mean, I find it amazing. I have some students who listen to the Beatles all the time and love the Beatles, and that's an extraordinary thing right there. I think that in their own way, the Beatles captured something, transcended the age that they were in, and that's why they're still listened to and loved today.
Well, you may be interested to know that one of my 8-year-old twin grandsons has just discovered the Beatles, and he can't get enough of them.
Ha, there you go. Exactly.
In Minnesota.
Great.
Do you know when all these things came together, when Johnny Cash changed country music, and when Christopherson, who's one of my favorite writers, wrote about it, all of this music kind of came together, where there weren't just country stations, there weren't just rock stations, there was a whole new music. Now, the thing that bothers me about some of the present music, even the stuff that I really like, like Springsteen. You can't understand it the way you can understand the words to the Beatles songs and to Christopherson songs and the, to other songs like that. I love the energy of Springsteen, but I don't often understand all his words.
Yeah, well, it's tough. I agree with you. And, you know, and if anything, Springsteen is not even that modern. He himself probably was at his height maybe 20 years ago, 15 years ago. And he's probably more understandable than some other artists as well. I mean, look, there are some, you know, my kids love rap music. And they get an enormous amount out of it. And actually, rap can be and is very lyrically sophisticated. And I think it accomplishes a lot there. But I don't think it has a transcendent quality that the Beatles do. And I'm not surprised to hear that Priscilla's 8-year-old grandson is discovering the Beatles. Because there's a certain... it's in the same way that... I mean, look, let's face it, we don't go out and most people and see Shakespearean plays these days. But anytime we're exposed to it, if we do see some of Shakespeare, we instantly, respond to it. Because even though it was a long time ago, Shakespeare touched some, you know, fundamental human qualities. Or, you know, just something slightly earlier than the Beatles and rock and roll. If you think about Rodgers and Hammerstein and their, you know, kind of music and plays, the reason that they, when they're revived, they do so well is because they hit on something also. So,
well, they also, I don't know where this phrase was coined, but I think it was used in a Bob and Ray skit, actually. Something about makes you go home humming the melody.
Yeah.
You know, it's you keep it with you. But I don't mean to suggest that's all Rodgers and Hammerstein were, because certainly some of their plays, I'm thinking particularly of Carousel and Oklahoma and others as well, but they're pretty deep.
They are, absolutely. Very deep.
In 1978, there was a very important year in my life. I heard a romantic song that is still something to both Barbara and I, because that was the year that she and I got married.
So many nights I sit by my window waiting for someone to sing me his song. So many dreams I kept deep inside me, alone in the dark, but now you've come along and you light up my life. You
and I play that song on my Echo to wake me up in the morning.
Yeah, that by the way, that's speaking of Pat Boone. That's by his daughter, right? You
and it's the
life.
Only hit that I think she ever had.
Yeah,
and I enjoyed that so much. You mentioned Oklahoma. I'm going to read one more, and then we'll come back to it because it reminded me of it. I lit Gordon McRae's cigarette. I was standing at the bar in a restaurant in Shea Stadium after a World Series game in 1969. I lit a cigarette, you could smoke in bars then, as I tried to figure out why no money was changing hands over the bar. Just then, the fellow next to me asked for a light, and as I turned to light his cigarette, I recognized that it was Gordon McRae, who had sung the national anthem before the game. Over Gordon's head, I saw Joe DiMaggio talking to Earl Warren at the end of the bar, and I realized I was not in the public restaurant. It turned out that I was in the private club of the owner of the Mets, so I stayed. But I did not want to just sound like a fan, so I told how much I liked him in the movie version of Oklahoma. I also did not tell him how much I despised the state of Oklahoma, having spent 5 long years there between January 1962 and April 1962, while in the Army. It was only 4 months. It felt like 5 years. Gallatin was the third largest city in the state and had no industry other than Fort Sill, where I was. It had bars, many, private clubs, hotels, clip joint, girls, anything that could separate a GI from his meager wages. It was a divided city with the Mexican section, an Indian section, the black section, the white soldier section, and a white real people section. And for the first time, this New Yorker saw institutional segregation and bigotry. About 20, 25 years later, I met a woman from Lawton and told of black members of my unit being refused service in a bar where I was. I left with them. I then said, I'm sure that things have changed in the last 25 years. And she responded, not so much. I told Gordon none of this. I just lit his cigarette. He was an interesting guy. I got to talk to him for a while. So, when you mentioned Oklahoma, Priscilla, we're talking about the Broadway thing or the revivals, or you're talking about the movie?
Well, I was talking about the Broadway show. I never saw it on Broadway. I heard the music. We used to listen to the music at home. And I did see the film, and I haven't seen the revival. I would love to see it. I watched the Tonys and was really impressed by some of the music they had from it on the Tonys.
Yeah, the movie, if you remember, it was, as we said, it was Gordon McRae, but he also
it was
hosted...
Gordon McRae. Was it Gordon McRae or John Raitt?
No, it was Gordon McRae. It was on Broadway.
Priscilla's right. The movie was John Raitt. The Broadway play was, there were a couple of other guys in there, too, though. But you think it was Gordon McRae in the Broadway play, the lead male?
I thought it was the opposite. But if you remember, Gordon McRae also hosted a radio show that my parents used to listen to called The Railroad Hour.
Yeah.
That was on it once a week. Or whatever, and it was music and he was singing. Barbara McMullen, who was the biggest McRae in the world, just said that he was in the movie.
Okay.
Oh.
All right.
Just got some feedback.
The aliens.
I just changed phones because that was killing the battery. I will look it up. Paul, would you send me it up?
Yeah, I'm looking it up right now.
Good.
I'll tell you who is. these are the different people that played Curly, actually. Alfred Drake, Harry Stockwell, John Raitt, Howard Keel, Rich Bond, Hugh Jackman, Patrick Wilson, Lawrence Picard, and Damon Dono. Yeah, in different productions. If you can trust Wiki.
No, that's right. Howard Keel also was in Dallas, the television show. He played
Howard Keel?
Yep, he was. He played some old guy.
He was also in Jupiter's Darling with Esther Williams. He had a great voice. Yeah. He was also in...
Kiss Me, Kate.
Kiss Me, Kate, that's right.
And
probably the greatest Cole Porter musical of all time.
I agree.
The one
that's
with
fabulous.
Doris Day, where she was Calamity Jane. And she sang My Secret
Annie
Love.
Get Your Gun. It was Annie Get Your Gun? Yeah.
No, it was not that. It was that was the name of the movie, was Calamity Jane.
Okay.
And she was Calamity Jane. Did you look up the movie, though, Priscilla?
You know, it just got me into Wikipedia. I didn't look up. It didn't separate out. Here's the film. Okay, hold on. This is such a terrible thing to do.
No, why is it terrible?
The film, musical film starring Gordon McRae, Shirley Jones, and her film debut. Yeah.
I'm Shirley Jones, sure.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well,
and Rod
after Steiger. The war, would you send me the URLs of where people can will be able to get the recording, and also of the books all up on Amazon?
Yeah, my books are all up on Amazon. If you just do a search on Paul Levinson, you'll see a load of books. But The Plot to Save Socrates and The Silk Code should be right up there, and you can get them in hardcover, paperback. You can get them in Kindle, ebook editions, every conceivable format. And, yes, I'll definitely send you – what I'll do actually for starters is I have some rough mixes of a couple of songs already up, and people can just listen to them. But within a matter of a couple of days, we're going to have pre-order links if somebody wants to, buy the complete album at some kind of discount price. But I'll send you all that stuff, sure.
Okay, and Priscilla, I won't see you until you're back from Bali, I guess, right?
That's correct.
Okay.
Have a good trip. Priscilla, it was a pleasure meeting
you
and talking to you.
Thank
by
you.
The way.
Yeah, nice to meet you also.
Yeah. Take care.
Thanks.
And
I'm looking forward
to
reading your book.
Thank you very much
for
calling in. And
congratulations,
and what
John. This is your 300th. Congratulations to you.
Thank you. And it's my last for a while. And
all
I'm
right,
going to go walk.
Come back.
Go ahead.
Okay? Come back someday. If you need a little time off, that's fine, but you're really unique. And, sometimes there's an ebb and flow to everything. You might look at one show and see you didn't have many listeners or whatever, but your show is a show for the ages, and you should, continue doing it when you're in the mood to, obviously, but don't let it fade away.
Thank you very much, Paul. And we'll go off tonight, instead of going off as I normally do, with my favorite group of all time, and Beatles people may take this as a sacrilege. I'm an Eagles fan, but I'm going to go off with Whitney.
If I should stay, I would only be in your way, so I'll go, but I know I'll think of you every step of the way. And I'll love you, my darling.